This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Science Fiction. I'm Rob Wolf, and I'm very happy to bring you the Cats Are People Too episode. Today we're going to be talking about a book that illuminates, among other things, the importance of careful planning. And I'm not talking about planning for a trip or planning a wedding, but more like a planet-wide form of urban planning where careful and equitable balancing of people's needs, the environment's needs, aesthetics, costs, and all those things can produce a community that works for everyone for years, and I mean many years in the future. My guest today is Annalee Newitz, who is here to talk about their forthcoming book, The Terraformers. Annalee Newitz writes science fiction and nonfiction. They are the author of Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age, and Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction, which was a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize in Science. They're also the author of the novels The Future of Another Timeline and Autonomous, which won the Lambda Literary Award. As a journalist, they are a writer for the New York Times and elsewhere and have a monthly column in New Scientist. They are also the co-host of the Hugo Award-winning podcast Our Opinions Are Correct. Previously, they were the founder of IO9 and served as the editor-in-chief of Gizmodo. Annalee joins me now from their home in San Francisco. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back because there's always wonderful and interesting things to talk about. Today is The Terraformers, which is it's such a great book to start the podcasting year, I think, because it's ultimately an optimistic book about the positive directions a society can move when everyone works together in a collaborative, equitable, and democratic way. What made you want to write this story, The Terraformers?
You know, I had been noodling for a long time on thinking about a story where a lot of the characters were non-human animals. I've always loved stories about that. I grew up reading Beatrix Potter and watching Lassie's Rescue Rangers. And I still, when I'm feeling sad or scared, I sometimes think about Lassie's Rescue Rangers. And I'm like, they'll save us. And so I had that in the back of my mind. And then, you know, I just finally felt like now was the time to do it. The pandemic was really tough and the political situation in the United States was really unstable. And I feel like in dark times in reality, it's really important to write stories that show a pathway out, not like a candy-coated utopia, like, you know, la la la, everything could be better, but like look, things are hard, but like there are ways to get out of it. And there's many ways, there's many pathways out. And so with a big sprawling multi-generational book, it's a place to show all of those pathways, or at least a fraction of those pathways, and not suggest that there's only one solution.
Well, I thought it would be a fun way to get listeners to get a feel for the book if you tell us about the two characters we meet at the book start, Destry Thomas and Whistle. So who are they and what's their relationship?
So Destry Thomas is a network analyst from a group called the Environmental Rescue Team. And 60,000 years in our future, this group, the Environmental Rescue Team, has become an interplanetary force for first responders and environmental engineers who work together to keep environments in balance, to keep ecosystems in balance, but also to stage rescue operations when people are suffering from disasters, whether those disasters are political or natural disasters. And we see an example of both of those in the book. So Destry is living on a planet called Saski, and her job is to just maintain the ecosystems, to keep them nice and pristine and working fine until the company that owns the planet sells it all off as real estate. And she is joined by her trusty steed, the moose named Whistle. And it's 60,000 years in the future, people. So I'm like, of course, Whistle can talk and fly. Just go with it, okay? And Whistle actually is a perfect replica of a moose from Earth's Pleistocene. So he can't talk with his mouth. It's not like a cartoon where his lips flap. He has an implant in his head that can send texts. So he and Destry are always texting each other. So he can actually make a moose noise and talk at the same time, which is kind of a fun thing to imagine. And how, why can he fly? Because gravity mesh, obviously. We're going to have a thing called gravity mesh that we can implant into living beings and make them fly. So that is the, I would say, the one point of complete fantasy in this book. I can't imagine how gravity mesh would work, but let's just say it does.
Well, it's funny because that was the thing that got me. I'm reading, okay, there's a sentient moose communicating with Destry. They're buddies. They communicate by text. You know, Destry also has sensors embedded in her so she can actually communicate not just with Whistle, but with the environment, the soil. But the thing that really surprised me the most is when Destry gets on Moose and then they leap into the air and they just keep going up, up, up. And I was like, wait, where are the wings? Were there wings? And then I realized, oh, no. And then you refer to the gravity mesh and, you know, it's not just Whistle. There's all sorts of things that could just pop up into the air.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who can fly and robots and, of course, vehicles and things like that. So, like I said, it really was, I just permitted myself that one piece of fantasy because I just, again, every time I thought about the physics of it, I was like, and where would all the energy be going? Ah, let's not worry about it. They can do all kinds of crazy stuff in the future.
Exactly. Once you say 60,000 years, it's all bets are off. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
So listeners don't get the impression that this is all just, you know, happy fantasy. We already are introduced through Whistle to a kind of inequity, although we don't fully understand it, I think, at first. But Whistle can communicate by text, but there are limits to what Whistle can say. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because in L'Orange, the city where they are based, that's owned by this company, Verdance, that owns the planet, they have certain ratings, certain people, and I want to talk about that. Everyone is a person. Whistle is a person. Destry is a person. But some people have limits on how they can communicate, and they actually have ratings. You know, it feels like a caste system. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is a caste system. And this is a future where all of the beings that we meet are fabricated. So they've been genetically engineered. They've been grown in tanks. When they are decanted, which is what they say for being born, they're basically adults. And they kind of are brought up to speed, but they are born with certain kinds of intelligence built in. And I use the term intelligence very guardedly because the caste system is one of intelligence. They have what are called intelligence assessment ratings, which are something that's actually regulated by an interstellar, interplanetary agency. And not every community that we meet uses them, but they are, but anyone is permitted to use them. And basically what happens is that when certain creatures are being built, they're built with limiters in their brains. And what that means is not that they are actually less intelligent, but simply that they can't express themselves in ways that makes them make them sound intelligent. So in the case of Whistle, this was actually really fun for me to write, but Whistle is only able to write in monosyllabic words. So he winds up sounding like a child because he's just, even though in his head he has all of these multisyllabic words, but he's just not permitted to text them. And so he's classified with these intelligence assessment ratings as what's called a mount. And if you will permit me an odd digression, the reason I chose to call him a mount and the reason why I have so much fury in this book around the idea of mounts and how they're rated is because I had been playing a Dungeons and Dragons game where my character was an Arakocra, which is a flying, it's like a bird person. And Arakocras in previous editions of D&D were classed as mounts. And that meant that they could not be, they were not playable characters, but you could ride them. And then they became playable characters. And once they were playable characters, you couldn't ride them anymore, which seems kind of weird. But my character was really pissed off about how their people had been treated as mounts. And I really got into it. And then I was like, I'm going to put this character, you know, as sort of a that character into this novel. I think the designers of D&D should be ashamed of themselves, but also the people in the world that I've built should be ashamed of themselves, because as the many of the characters refer to these ratings as in-ass ratings, because you have to have your head in your ass to buy into intelligence assessment. And we meet a lot of other characters who have other kinds of intelligence assessment ratings, and they've been limited in other ways and what they can express. And I think it's a very socially realistic idea that if people could do something like this, they would, because there's a real obsession among humans on Earth right now with this idea that you can measure intelligence and that we can allocate jobs based on it, that we can make determinations about people's future based on it, even though at the same time, as we start to build artificial intelligence, we're starting to realize that we have no freaking clue what intelligence is, that there's a million kinds of intelligence. There's almost no way to measure it. It's just this kind of ineffable thing. It's like love. You can't measure love either, but we talk about it all the time like you can. So it was something that has really preoccupied me a lot. And I really go pretty deep on it in this book, dealing with prejudices around what intelligence is and how people are kind of imprisoned by the way that they're treated based on how intelligent they seem.
What's fascinating is that Destry hasn't really thought about what the limiter does. And it's a revelation to her when she realizes that Whistle has always had more complex thoughts, but just been unable to express them. And that really underscores, of course, it's very writerly to underscore the importance of language, but how we might judge someone on that basis in that very particular form of communication when, as you say, there are so many other ways to have intelligence, express intelligence, understand the world, experience the world.
Yeah. And I wanted to take readers on that journey with Destry and have us watch her figuring out what's really been going on and realize that she kind of always guessed that Whistle was just as intelligent as she was or just as perceptive as she was, perhaps, but she didn't understand that how he had sort of been mentally abused in this way. So Whistle's journey is a big part of the book, and what happens to him is very important.
You work as a science journalist, and I think that clearly complements your fiction. And that really hit home for me as I was reading this book, because I had heard earlier this year the episode you did on the Media in January with Brooke Gladstone. You were co-hosts together.
Yeah.
And on that episode, you explored attitudes towards Neanderthals. I know that's considered, I don't know if that's the proper way to say it. That's certainly one way to say it. And you looked at how the evidence didn't line up along these lines here, you know, with what, you know, our obsession Homo sapiens obsession. Of course, amongst ourselves, we're rating each other. But then when we look at other species, we rate other species. Of course, they're all inferior to us, including the Neanderthals.
Who... Yeah, rate my species.
Exactly. So the whole episode explored this idea that non-Homo sapiens, like Neanderthals, like all animals that we're familiar with, they need a rethink. And that really permeates the feeling, the culture of the terraformers. So I guess, I mean, we've kind of already talked about that, but just this idea that by calling everyone people or considering everyone people, you know, it changes how you think of them. And just for listeners, again, you know, in the book, cats are people and naked mole rats are people. And of course, we've already gone over moose are people and earthworms are people. A door can even be a person. So I guess maybe there's, I feel like there's more maybe you could say about that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted people to think about the environment the way we think about each other. And when I say each other, I mean when we think about our communities of people who we care about. And one of the big issues, I think, around getting people into a frame of mind where we're going to deal with climate change by changing our relationship to the environment, changing our relationship to energy use and things like that, is that in the West, you know, the European culture of the West, we've really been taught to see humans as us and everything else as them. And I mean, and of course, within humans, we also have a lot of us and them too, but just for the moment, let's think about the environment. And so I really wanted to kind of suggest a pathway out of that. And I think this almost fairy tale approach to imbuing everything in the environment with life was my way of getting people to think, oh, wait, the tree has life, the train has life, the naked mole rat has life. All of us have life because we all have a role to play in the ecosystem around us. So that was a big part of what I was trying to do. And really, other than the gravity mesh, I really did try to have a very grounded, scientifically accurate approach to thinking about ecosystems. For example, when Destry, my network analyst, connects to the environment, she has these sensors in her hands. She's reading a vast sensor network that's sort of all over the planet. There's these tiny microscopic biodegradable sensors that the environmental rescue team has scattered everywhere so that they can read the health of the trees, of the soil, of the insects, of everything. And so it gives Destry this almost magical connection to the planet, kind of Avatar style, except it's not some hokey tree of life thing. It's actually, no, it's just a sensor network, much like sensor networks that we're developing now on Earth and using in a lot of places. So that was kind of what I was thinking about.
And the history, which you referred to, I guess, sort of obliquely, I mean, it's the backstory somewhere. I mean, it could be its own book, I think, but there are references to the farm revolutions and the Great Bargain. My sense of it was, and you don't go, you treat it appropriately as like such ancient history that it's just referred to casually and not in great detail. But I would be interested in hearing what story you told yourself about what those things were, what happened, and what is the Great Bargain.
Yeah, so you're right that it's such deep backstory that the characters kind of take it for granted in the same way that, you know, human beings now take for granted that we cook. You know, we cook food. But, you know, 60,000 years ago, people were not necessarily cooking food. Well, maybe not 60,000 years ago, but like a million years ago, our ancestors were just starting to tame fire, which meant they got to start cooking food. So somebody had that idea, and then it became just totally normalized. So I wanted them to be thinking about us as ancient history. And the farm revolutions are, I did think about all of this stuff a lot, and I did create a timeline. And what I was imagining is that sometime in our future, maybe 200, 300, 400 years in our future, there's incredible environmental adversity. We've had sea level rise, crop failures, fires, pandemics, all the stuff that comes with habitat perturbation, and that we're already seeing now. And there's a population crash, but the people who are best equipped to deal with it are people in northerly areas, like say in Saskatchewan or in northern Canada. And it's a lot of people who are already involved in environmental projects. Like they're either involved in environmental activism or they're scientists who've been studying how to grow crops that are going to be sustainable in a new kind of ecosystem, right? In a changing world. And a few of those individuals who we do hear a little bit about them in the book, a few of those individuals kind of lead a movement, which becomes the Farm Revolutions. And it's kind of a futuristic green revolution. You know, it's just a new approach to genetic engineering, which allows us to survive in a climate unstable world. And part of what happens at that point, again, as in my imaginary history, is that the people who are leading this farm revolution realize that part of the problem has been that we've been trying to shepherd ecosystems without asking other creatures in the ecosystem what they think about it. And at that point, they have the technology to build non-human animals with human equivalent consciousness. And they start to do it, and they call it the Great Bargain, because it's a bargain between Homo sapiens and all of the other life forms around them. And so they start with farm animals and other animals that are in their environment, so cows and moose, cats, and start asking them, what do you think? How should we rebuild? How should we make this civilization happen? And this is a world where they already have robots that have sentience. So humans have already accepted that there's non-human intelligence, but they haven't quite accepted that there could be other life forms, like not life forms that we didn't actually invent in a machine shop. So that great bargain and that idea of joining with non-human life forms in a revolution to change how we farm, how we do agriculture, that kind of leads to the environmental rescue team. And they become kind of they're a scientific order. They're also kind of spiritual. They spread out across the galaxy on different planets and kind of set up little campuses where they work, and they don't affiliate with governments. They don't affiliate with corporations. They try to spread the credo of living in balance and spread the ideals of the Great Bargain. And, you know, there's lots of weird byways in this. For example, I was saying, like, well, humans hadn't accepted that non-human animals could be just like us, could be people. But of course, at the same time, the way that they end up talking to cows is by building cows that have human perception and can communicate with us. So it's further transformations of nature in a sense. So there's definitely, it's not perfect. It's hard to know, like, what would a Pleistocene original cow really think? We aren't able to know that. And so anyway, you could kind of go really far down the sort of philosophical rabbit hole with this. And some of the characters definitely do, which, you know, that could be a whole other story. But by the time my characters are coming around, you know, the environmental rescue team is just natural to them. The Great Bargain is natural. People talk about it as just a kind of a philosophical way of life. It's more like Buddhism than it is like Christianity. It's kind of a way of living. And certain characters really buy into it, and other characters don't really care about it, just like any other kind of spiritual path. And they have their own new problems. You know, the farm revolutions and the Great Bargain solved the problems of the Anthropocene. And they do talk about the Anthropocene as being, oh, that thing that happened in the past. Gosh, that was a time. And but now they're facing brand new systems of oppression and colonization. So the fight goes on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's interesting as you talk about the installation of human intelligence, say, or modeled on human intelligence in other species, and then asking those species what they think. So, you know, on the other hand, there are cases in the terraformers where the hominids, or no, the people, that's not just, it's people. I think it was the naked mole rats, maybe, who decide to bring earthworms into the great bargain. Because although they may have this kind of intelligence that I suppose was originally framed around human intelligence, they also bring their own knowledge based on some quality that is earthwormness that allows them to solve a problem that the naked mole rats can't solve. So it's interesting just to see how it isn't entirely human. It's emerging. You know, each species is bringing something unique to the conversation.
Yeah, they're bringing their own perspective. And the way I think about it, and the way the characters think about it, is not so much like we're turning cows into like humans in a cow suit. It's much more the idea of the great bargain is we bring them into conversation with us. We create a way for humans to hear what they want. And the fact is, as we discover over and over and over again, when non-human animals are given the ability to communicate, they often do not want what humans want. They often argue and push back and revolt, and get really pissed off. So it's not a way of creating just a bunch of little humans. But on the other hand, it's, you know, they are changing the nature of these animals.
Let's talk about something that runs through all the parts of the book. As you say, it's multi-generational. The story takes place over thousands of years, really. One thing that recurs in each major section of the book is love. And you referenced that before. And, you know, there are moose falling in love with moose. You know, okay, easy to imagine, right? There's an archaean, which is a form of homonym. And there's an archaean falling in love with a homo sapien. Okay, got that. And then there is a cat falling in love with a flying train. So it's a little harder to fathom, at least if you hear it. I'm sure listeners are like, what? But you make it believable. You make the story. You make it believable because they're real characters, and why wouldn't they fall in love or fall, you know, into a deep and committed relationship? So I was wondering if there was something, you know, you had in mind, something you hope readers take from these stories of these loving relationships among people who, at least externally, are very different.
I mean, yeah, again, I think it's about how do we empathize with our environment? And the environment doesn't just include plants and animals and human. It's, you know, the environment is everything. And I wanted to model what it looks like for creatures who are not the same species or not the same type of built creature to love each other because they have common cause or because they both like video games. In one case, the cat and the train just love video games. And I mean, they're very futuristic, immersive video games. They're not playing Pong, although maybe they are. I don't know. You know, it's the same thing with the archaean, who's kind of a type of hominin, like you said, and their relationship with this homo sapiens. And it's really, to go back to Neanderthals, which you mentioned earlier, one of the big shifts in our understanding of Neanderthals came about, I want to say about 15 years ago, when the DNA from a Neanderthal finger bone was sequenced at the Max Planck Institute. And what it revealed was that Homo sapiens and Neanderthals had been having children together the whole time. Okay. It wasn't just like once. And a lot of us have a little bit of DNA from Neanderthal ancestors. And I'm sure that's true of other archaic humans, early humans as well. All of these different humans were falling in love or at least having sex and reproducing. And I wanted to evoke that and point out that in order for us to live in balance, that we do have to extend love in places that we might not expect. A lot of this book is about having uprisings against systemic oppression. In this case, it's capitalism because they're dealing with a couple of very greedy corporations, real estate corporations. And I really believe that if we're going to fight something that is systemic, it has to be sustained by love and community. And of course, the smallest unit of community really is love. And, you know, that doesn't mean you have to like love everyone in your community. That would be sometimes just untenable. But we do have to be bound together by that kind of feeling. And so I wanted especially the cat and the train to fall in love because the train is part of a public transit system. And I really love public transit. And I have a lot of tender feelings toward the trains in San Francisco and actually trains in other towns too. The train in Terraformers is actually based on the trains in Melbourne, Australia. And I just wanted people to have a way of thinking about these different entities, these different stakeholders emotionally, instead of thinking that it was just purely political. I feel like I'm not expressing that well, but really it's just about the feels. It's about the big feelings.
No, I think you've captured that well. And it relates to another thought I had based on your talking about the cat and the train's love of games, video games, because at one point they go into a bar or, an establishment where people get to beta test games. And someone, I think it was a bot, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. who has a game that they're very excited about sharing and want tested. And it's based on the farm revolutions. But
yeah.
But their idea was, no, we're not going to just turn the legendary people who participate in that into, we're not going to exaggerate them. We're going to do literally what happened. And what happens, as your book makes clear, because your book takes place over thousands of years, it's that building complex things, making revolutions, making new societies, making planets takes time. And so the game ends up being very boring. And yeah. I was going to say, but your story is also about making big things, making planets, making new societies, but it's not boring. And I think that's why it's not boring, because you emphasize the character, the love and the connection. And so you're telling stories about the individuals within these larger landscapes. And yet you don't shy away. I mean, many of their conversations are nitty-gritty conversations about, well, if we do this, the river will go here. And well, what are the pros and cons? And so, I mean, beyond putting some love and sex in the story and bring the characters forward, I mean, are there other strategies you did to really tell such an interesting story about these slow evolving events?
I mean, I think one of the wonderful things about fiction is that you can actually tell a story that takes place over 1,000 years in like 100,000 words or a little, give or take a little bit. And so, I mean, I made liberal use of skipping through time. You know, we skip over 1,000 years between each section, I believe. And of course, these are also characters who, like a lot of characters in post-human science fiction, they all have very extended lifespans. So they're living for 1,000 years or 5,000 years, depending on how many upgrades they have access to, how much money they have. So that's one way, is just to be able to like zoom in and zoom out. And there are some scenes in the book where characters actually say like, this is really boring. They're having like a council meeting at one point that just goes on and on. And the cat character is just like, oh, government is boring. Like, I want to have a government, but I don't want to sit through a government meeting. which I think is how a lot of us feel. And I think if we have good government, like, not everyone should have to sit through the meeting, but someone should take notes and someone should be there. So that's part of it. And I think part of it too is that, you know, in that scene with the bot who's trying to build the very accurate game about the farm revolutions, that bot is trying to retell a story where the heroes of the farm revolution come like roaring out of the sky on like serpents, and they're like, they have flamethrowers and like dragons, and they like beat the evil capitalists, and they, you know, they rescue the world, you know, they draw the continents back up out of the water. And I mean, I have my characters do a little bit of that. Like I said, you know, they fly and they do get to fight in very heroic battles. There's like a volcano war, again, very realistically described. I actually consulted with a geologist who studies rivers about how you would build a dam out of lava. And that was very helpful. So it is very dramatic in the book, but it's also realistic. But the flying is not realistic. So there are characters who do come flying in out of the sky like mythological characters. And I think, you know, every great revolutionary story needs at least one moment of just that feeling of when your heart just explodes in your chest, when like the heroes come and you know that the day is going to be saved. We just need that feeling, because without it, the story becomes a bit grindy, and it becomes more like realist fiction, which I love realism. And there is a lot of realism in here, but come on, I'm doing sci-fi. I want to have my flying out of the sky moment. So there is that.
You balance it well. There's, you know, the action and the sort of thoughtful, wonky planning moments, geoengineering or planet engineering.
I hope so. There is a lot of wonky discussion of rivers, yeah.
Well, one thing I feel like we could use now, and I don't know how one ever gets it because it seems so antithetical to the way humans think, is that your characters are thinking not just, you know, about next year. They're not thinking about 100 years. They're thinking thousands of years into the future. And they're taking actions based on that awareness. And obviously, that's something we don't do today, and we have such a hard time doing, and why climate change, why we're screwing ourselves with that, and all kinds of things. You know, it feels like if only we could do what's happening in the terraformers, we'd be, we could set ourselves on a decent path.
I mean, we are setting ourselves on a path. That's the thing, is I feel like even if you decide, okay, we're not going to do anything about burning fossil fuels or engaging in, you know, really damaging farm practices, you know, factory farming and that sort of thing, you're still looking into the future and saying, I just don't give a crap what happens. Like, I know that this is going to blow up in our faces and I just don't care. And in a sense, that is also planning for the future. It's just planning to screw over the future. And interestingly, a lot of the people who make those kinds of plans screw people over in the present too. Those are the same people who are screwing over workers in Amazon warehouses and farm workers who are, you know, asked to work in punishing heat without unionization, without any limits on their hours. And so, yeah, no surprise that their future plans are basically like, you know, the boot on your nuts forever. Or if you have nuts, the boot on whatever part of your body you would like to protect forever. So I think, you know, we have to start realizing that it's not a matter of learning to plan for the future. It's just learning to plan for a future that we feel tenderly about, and about thinking about how we want to treat people in the future. And, you know, there's many cultures on Earth that do incorporate ideas of planning for future generations and respecting future generations. And I think, unfortunately, right now, we're all, especially in kind of capitalist Western countries, we're really slotted into this one vision of the future where, and the vision is, we eat everything, we consume everything until it's gone, and then, well, they'll just eat something else, or who cares? Like, those people will just, maybe they'll just die, I don't care, because I got my food that I ate, and I ate all the metal on the planet. So I think if we can start in the present, treating our communities better and treating them more respectfully, it'll become easier and easier to think about the future as a community that we treat respectfully too.
Words to live by.
Words to Hope By.
Words to Hope By, yes. Well, thank you so much. This has really been absolutely fascinating and so fun. Great, fun book to read. I urge everyone to pick up The Terraformers, and that will be out at the end of January. It's from Tor Books. Thank you. Thanks for coming back on the show. Your two previous books you were on to discuss. So 3 for 3.
Yeah. Well, I always love talking with you. I always ask the best questions, and you're such a thoughtful reader. So thank you so much for having me back.
Well, thank you. Thank you. My pleasure. I've been talking to Annalee Newitz, and I am Rob Wolf, your host for this episode of New Books in Science Fiction. Marshall Poe is the editor and founder of the New Books Network, and Leanne Wilson is co-editor. Our theme music is by Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com. Please subscribe to the show. You know, please give us a good review if you're in the mood. It's such a nice thing to do. I'll be back next time with my co-host, Brenda Nweser. Happy New Year, everyone, and happy reading.